Tell me, what is Blackbird?
Let me take you back to the start of Blackbird. It's Sydney, 2012. There was no local venture capital, no local investors available to them who kind of knew what they were doing. The founders of Blackbird, Rick and Nikki, they'd had experience being founders. They were like, hey, why? Like, what's going on? There's such a massive opportunity in Australia. No one's investing in these companies. We should do this.
Meet Phoebe Harrop, a partner at Blackbird in New Zealand. Discover her path to Blackbird, a top venture capital firm in Australasia. With a portfolio exceeding $7 billion, Blackbird fuels the success of early-stage startups across New Zealand.
So they went out to try and raise a big fund. The pitch totally fell flat with all the big sources of money. And they pieced together this fund. They got $30 million together, and that fund went on to invest in the first round of Canva, which is now a $25 billion company.
This is the Fresh Money Podcast.
74% of Pacifica, 56% of Māori feel unconfident or unsure when making financial decisions. This podcast is all about opening up the conversation of money and to help everyone get better at it. So if you can please like and subscribe, it's our promise to interview more people who can help and inspire you to become better with money. Please note that this podcast does not constitute financial advice. If you are needing financial advice, please consult a professional or get in touch and we can point you in the right direction. I'm Willie Leota and welcome to the Fresh Money Podcast. On this podcast, we'll be talking to you about all things money, which is somewhat a taboo subject, from personal finance, business, and investment. If it involves money, we'll be talking about it. I'm really stoked, I really am, to be welcoming Phoebe Harrop from Blackbird. Phoebe, welcome.
Hey, Willie.
It's awesome to have you on Fresh Money today. Why don't we start by introducing yourself, who you are and what you do.
Yeah, for sure. And such a pleasure to be here. So thank you for having me on. So, I'm Phoebe. I am originally from New Plymouth and went all the way from the wonderful metropolis of New Plymouth across to London, where I spent 8 years building my career in first consulting and then investing. Oh, wow. And then returned to these shores in 2021 to join Blackbird, where I'm a general partner now, which means I spend my days investing in wild hearts with wild ideas right at the beginning of their journeys. And we can unpack all of that, but that's kind of me in 10 seconds.
Awesome. That's podcast though.
Yeah, I think we're over.
Tell me, what is Blackbird? Like, obviously you invest a little bit. Mm-hmm. Tell me how does it work?
All right.
Like, do you get money from somewhere, from some random people, unknown people, and then you invest? Is that how it kind of works?
That's not wrong. Okay. But let me break it down a little bit more. Okay. Cool. So we're a venture capital fund.
Yep.
Venture capitalists, let's just say VC investors like me, yes, our job are to meet people who are starting tech companies or running tech companies, select which ones we want to invest in. So do work to understand, is this an idea that we want to back? Win the right to invest, because, you know, great companies get a lot of offers for investment, and we have to kind of compete to win the right to invest. Then we work with those companies, those founders, after we've invested. Yep. And then we have to fundraise ourselves. Actually, this should be step one. So every 4 years, we go and rattle the tin and try and raise money that we can, we call it raising a fund, big pot of money that we can go and then invest in all those startups. So from the Blackbird perspective, let me take you back to the start of Blackbird.
Yeah, cool.
So it's Sydney, 2012. There have been some epic companies built from Australia. Mm. Atlassian would be a standout one. I don't know what the market cap of, meaning what all its shares are worth, is right now, but it'll be in the tens of billions of dollars. Yeah, well, was founded by two Australians in Sydney, but in order to scale their business, there was no local venture capital, no local investors available to them, who kind of knew what they were doing and saw the ambition that they had and could fund it. So it was clear that Australia could produce these companies, you know, looking over in New Zealand, same situation, Trade Me, Xero, those sorts of companies had really gotten to scale without the help of venture capital funding. Mm. Really different to, say, in Silicon Valley, where there was a really well-established network of investors who could help these wild ideas come to fruition. Yeah. And so the founders of Blackbird Rick and Nikki, they'd had experience being founders and also in fundraising for venture capital. They were like, hey, why? Like, what's going on? There's such a massive opportunity in Australia. Yeah, no one's investing in these companies. We should do this. So they went out to try and raise a big fund, and the pitch totally fell flat with all the big sources of money, like the institutional money managers. Like they were like
super funds.
Yeah, those super type funds. Yeah, they were like Australian startups. Yeah. What? This is never going to be a thing. Yeah. So they did manage to raise a fund over about 600 coffee meetings. One-to-one meetings basically with people who'd been founders, had worked for Silicon Valley companies, maybe a few high net worth individuals, but it was all individual people putting in like 100K, something like that. And they pieced together this fund. They got $30 million together, which is a pretty nice fund for a first time. And that fund went on to invest in the first round of Canva, which is now a $25 billion company. And so
how much was that first?
The first investment,
yeah.
I think it was $250,000 they invested. Oh. And then, so there's a few things that came out of this. One is that Blackbird went on to invest in every round that Canva raised. So as Canva is an example, as they got bigger and bigger and more ambitious, we did too. So
crazy.
The team grew, we raised bigger funds so that we could be relevant in those, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars sized rounds. And
because then you've got those larger VCs jumping on board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Rick, who is still on the board of Canva, and it's just something that's really enabled. It's a proof point for why it's possible to build world-changing companies from this part of the world. And it has actually, you can imagine, really piqued the interest of those sources of capital that weren't interested to begin with. So a lot of superannuation funds are now investors in Blackbird. And the success of Canva and a couple of other companies of their vintage have really shown the potential for startups in this part of the world. Now, in New Zealand, in Aotearoa, I believe we're at a similar spot to where Australia was maybe 5 or 6, 7 years ago. Okay. We're at a stage that a lot of people still are not aware of startups as a career path. It's not prestigious or something that you would even aspire to. Like, people here still want, you know, people want their kids to be accountants, doctors, lawyers. This is definitely the case in New Plymouth when I was growing up. Yeah. You know, success was like, if you were smart, you went to med school or law school, you know? And still, like, not a bad option.
Yeah, it's still a great career.
But we still culturally don't have that much awareness of startups. What we see is people starting tech companies because they land on some problem that they're super obsessed with. They want to make better. They want to, you know, improve their corner of the world in some way. And then they realize that the most effective way to do that is to build novel software or hardware, something that kind of fixes the user experience. And to do that, you actually need to bring on engineers, salespeople way before you have revenue.
Yeah, true.
And that's where venture capital helps. Yeah. So So just casting back a few years, Sam Wong, who's my colleague and partner here in New Zealand, she's from Australia, she kept meeting all these Kiwi founders who were coming to Sydney. About a third of the company she was meeting were based in New Zealand. And she's like, okay, something is happening there. There are a lot of people with really interesting ideas who want to build global companies but don't necessarily have that much capital to choose from in New Zealand. And so she packed up her English husband and her 5-month-old daughter, moved to Auckland, March 2020, COVID lockdown, greeted her on arrival.
At that time, wow.
And she raised a small New Zealand fund, which was $65 million in total, to just invest in Kiwi founders. I joined in about a year after she'd started investing that fund, and we're now onto our second fund, which is $80 million in size. We've invested in 27 Kiwi companies and in total have invested about actually $130 million. So a little bit more context on Blackbird. As I said, we started with the $30 million fund. That was 11 years ago. From then until now, we've gone on to raise more than $2 billion in funds.
Wow.
And those are worth $7 billion on paper, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's insane.
And we've seen this big shift from, like, you know, institutional grade capital, superannuation funds, foundations. We don't have any KiwiSaver funds working on it. It's an interesting question. We should come back to it because the New Zealand KiwiSaver landscape, I would say, is like less competitive, less innovative than Australia. It's also got a lot less money.
Yep.
And Australia, there's a few superannuation funds that have like really pushed the envelope and are interested in venture, especially some of the ones that are early Blackbird investors are like believe now.
Yeah,
they believe. Yep. And so they're participating. But not every, it's still kind of like a niche thing. So there's a lot more potential.
Yep.
And yeah, we have a small New Zealand fund, seems small in the scheme of Blackbird, but it's still a really meaningful fund, an early stage Australian fund that focuses on Aussie founders. And then we have this follow-on fund, which is where we can lead later stage venture rounds. So when companies are actually getting a lot bigger, we can make sort of $20, $30, $40 million investments.
So you're not just in at the start, when they need extra capital and raising or looking for more money, you follow on. Is that right?
Yeah, that's kind of our strategy, and we're a little different to some of the other funds locally in that our goal is to we probably meet about 300 founding teams a year, and we only invest in about 5 of them. So we're very selective.
Okay.
And then when we do invest, we invest. This is right at the beginning, usually, like their first round that they raise, maybe the second round that they raise, pre-seed or seed round, and we tend to lead round.
Pre-seed.
Yeah. What? These are all just funny names,
yeah.
And they don't really mean anything.
Okay. Like stage one, stage two, stage three?
Yeah,
stage
and you
four?
Know what? Canva never used these terms. They were just like round one, round two, or round A, round B, round C, or something. Yep. But it does have some meaning. So, typically, a pre-seed round is like the first time you go out to raise money, not just from your mum or your family or someone that was your teacher at school or something. And it's typically like, $200,000 to $500,000.
I see. Yeah.
You might have a professional investor like me in that round, but, maybe half of those rounds, it'll just be angel investors. We can talk about that. But individuals who've been successful in business, who are
individuals
investing their own money.
Got quite a bit of money. They're sitting in the bank and they're not too sure what to do with it. And they'll go, hey, that looks cool.
We can talk about that when we get to talk about like personal finance, because I think it's an interesting it's an interesting option for people as well. A seed round, what I have in mind when you say I'm going to raise a seed round is like you're probably going to raise about $2 million, maybe $2 to $4 million. And that's you're basically raising that amount of money so that you can accelerate something. It's like usually hiring. So you just want to – you can see an opportunity. Maybe you've already got a product. You might already have some customers to meet the demand – of the customers and to build the product you know that they want, you need to bring on 4 extra engineers. And that's when you come to a venture capital fund and you say, here's what we've got, here's where we're going, can we have some money to go faster? And if you think about a business like, say, Uber, that business couldn't have existed without venture capital because you kind of know it's a good idea, but to get it to scale, think about you have to onboard all these drivers, you have to have a network of drivers in cabs that makes it possible. There's like a minimum viable size before that service even works because you have to be able to stand out on the street, be able to get a cab and not be waiting more than 5 minutes. And so you have to bring all these drivers, you have to invest in the software product, you have to build like a network density in any place that you want to run the service. And to do that, you have to invest a lot of money up front before you're going to see the revenue come from that. So that's where venture capital is really like, that's what we're for.
Cool.
Big ideas. That won't happen unless you get an acceleration of money, basically.
Yeah, nice. And what's your role at Blackbird? Do you go and are you a hunter, like going around and like looking for all these cool businesses or tech companies? And
So the core of my job is all 5 of those things. It's meeting founders.
Okay.
That could be at events. It could be because someone I've invested in or know heard about someone raising money and they tell me, and then we meet. It's spending time going deep on the company with whatever information there is available. So that could be talking to some of the customers, building a thesis in my mind of like why I think this is a company that's maybe I should set the scene a little bit more. When our style of venture capital, because there are quite a few different types of fund.
Yeah.
So I'll talk about Blackbird because I know Blackbird best. Every time we invest, we want to be able to see a path to this company in front of us becoming a Canva.
Yeah.
So becoming a really big independent public company. That usually means the things that would help me believe that would be if it was a really unique product that no one had built before, that customers really love, where there's just such a, you know, the person who's building it, the founder at the center of it, is just overflowing with ideas about what they want to build next. So there's a big ambition for all of the pieces that are to come, all the chapters to come in the company's lives.
And it's kind of been laid out, this is what it's going to be, and these are the things.
Yeah, and look, things, almost nothing is what you think it's going to be at the end.
True.
But having a vision for what you want to build and that vision being really massive helps me understand that it could be a big business. Usually it means like not just building a business in New Zealand.
Mm.
Many of our companies are already right from the start, right from the pre-seed stage, distributing to overseas customers. You know, maybe they're building cloud software that you can subscribe to anywhere in the world.
Gotcha.
And so during that like selection phase of my job, it's really trying to understand, is the idea big enough? Is the do customers start to love it? Is the problem really painful? Is the product that this team is building really beautiful and great to use? Is this team working quickly to deliver product? Do they work with pace? And more than anything, at that stage, I'm just getting to know the founders because usually there's like not much to go on. And it's my job.
You guys can invest on an idea.
Totally. Right? Yep. Can be pre-product, pre-customer love, definitely pre-product market fit.
That's crazy.
And so it's a little bit actually more like being a sports coach because it's really talent spotting. It's like, are these incredible people?
Yeah. You're like a scout.
Yes.
Yep. And you're like an NBA scout.
And you want you want people with good ideas, but a lot of it is just about like at the start of a company's life, a tech company's life, all you have is a story that you're telling. And you're using that story to attract customers, to attract talent. And so I'm kind of wanting to understand, are you an epic storyteller? Mm. Are you someone who's going to magnetize people to you, to your mission, and be able to build something? So there's a lot of there's a lot to get right.
Yeah.
And, that's basically the main part of my job where I spend a lot of time is knowing which ones to bring to spend more time on.
Yeah.
So there's meeting founders, selecting which ones to invest in, and then there's winning the right to invest. So, you know, it's a little bit like getting married. You're going to spend the next 10 years with this company.
Yeah, it's a big commitment.
Huge commitment.
For both, right?
Yeah, and so you want to get to know each other as people. Yeah. You want to be really aligned on, like, what's the ambition for the business and not being having different hopes. Mm. Like, if I hope it's going to be a billion-dollar company and you hope that you're going to sell in 2 years and retire and buy a batch,
needs to be that alignment there of what you're expecting. Yeah.
And there's no right answer to what your aspiration is for a business at all.
True.
But it's more like just like let's be really clear about what success is for you so that we're not misaligned.
Yeah.
And then there's working with the founders after we invest.
Cool.
So there's like legal stuff in between where we like sign documents. Yes. We can talk about that if you want.
I was gonna say how do you support the businesses that you invest in? Yeah.
Well, there's support that I give as an individual. So that might be, you know, I'm on WhatsApp with you if there's anything that's on your mind. Monthly meetings to talk about, like, having someone like me who knows your business well but isn't running it to step back and say, like, what's going well, what's not going well, where can I help, and most importantly, where can I bring resources to help you?
Yep.
Because I haven't been a founder. My expertise is basically how to raise money, how to get investors to love you, and keep your company alive, which is pretty much the main concern of most founders at this stage. Because you know,
how do we pay the wages?
Yeah, exactly. I can't tell you how to build a beautiful product because I've never done it. But what I can do is pull on this incredible network that Blackbird has.
Mm.
We believe that founders need community before they need advice, and so we're all about
that's awesome.
That manifests in heaps of ways. One is, we spend a lot of time, money and attention bringing people together and, you know, creating the surface area for serendipity to strike. So just bring people together, whether it's over dinner or in a retreat situation. Sunrise is a big festival that we put on. That's all about just fostering interactions and connections between founders, but also their teams, not just founders. And so part of my job is to connect you to people who can help you. And so what I am good at is spotting patterns and knowing the people and the resources, whether it's like a blog post or a a podcast or something like that that could help. And I'm like a human router. So you give me a problem and I give you ideas. And yeah. And so we've got a community team as well at Blackbird who's they just focus all their time on intros, support for founders that's not introductions, like you're going through a tough time, maybe we'll send you a voucher to go get a couple of days, headspace, getting an unyoked cabin, or you just got married, we'll send you some champagne. So like, you know, acknowledging moments of truth. And then events. So we run 100 events a year, everything from Sunrise, which is massive, 800 people down in Shed 10 in Auckland, more like 2,000 people in Sydney at the event there that's happening in May, through to, you know, pizza and beer catch-ups of all of the finance leaders in our portfolio. So massive range of events as well.
Nice.
Final thing I'd say on that front, on the like, how do we help founders post-investment? Something that it's kind of gets at those other strategic pillars, but we're trying to build our networks massively in the US and the UK as two first markets outside of Australia and New Zealand, where a lot of our founders actually move their companies or they build teams in those markets because there are a lot of customers there. And so we're building Blackbird's brand so that we've got a local network in those markets for hiring purposes, for follow-on investment, and for our own fundraising as well. So that's like a new initiative that we're doing called Blackbird Abroad.
Wicked. That's amazing. So how do you, like, being a scout or being a partner sounds like a pretty cool job.
I think it's the best job ever.
How do you get one of those jobs? Is there a linear career path that leads you to that?
Or
similar themes that gets you there? Or
first of all, it's such a niche job. There are probably 30 or 40 people that do this full time in New Zealand. Do it for it, you know, get paid to do it on a professional basis. There's quite a few sort of individually wealthy people who angel invest, and but it is different being a lead investor, meaning you're putting in like a lot of money to each round. You're managing someone else's money, so you're answering to your own investors. A lot of them are basically the citizens of Australia who have entrusted their superannuation to us.
It's a lot of responsibility.
Yes, we have some New Zealand government funds, so we have taxpayer money. So, we're very conscious of where the money comes from. So the two main paths into becoming a partner at a VC fund, there's sort of the finance path or career investor path, and then there's the founder path. And the Blackbird partnership has a mix of both.
Okay.
So you have people like Nikki, who founded a company with Scott Farquhar, who went on to found Atlassian.
Okay.
So they founded a company not as successful as Atlassian, but still awesome. Before that, and he had been a founder in the US and decided to move to the investor side. So that's one example. Sam, my colleague here, had a legal tech startup that she took through StartMate, which is kind of about StartMate, like a sister company to Blackbird. Didn't go very well. In fact, she's always like embarrassed to talk about it, but what an incredible experience, because you even being a founder for a year, you just give us empathy for...
That's right. You know how it feels.
You know how the no's feel when, you know, you get the 50 no's from investors. Before that, she was a lawyer. Actually, I think 6 out of 7 Blackbird partners have law degrees. I don't know why, but it's back to that thing of like, if you don't know what you want to do and you're curious and you're pretty smart, then you're probably going to do a law degree, because it's like opens up doors,
There's a lot of crossover with it.
And for my part, I was never interested in business. Growing up, I didn't really know anyone who ran a business, never thought about technology companies, but I knew that I wanted to try and make some positive change when it comes to like health outcomes, education outcomes, climate change. Those things were motivating to me, so I went and did law. And then kind of through that, realized that actually law is not the most effective way to make change, like especially if you work with the smartest and most prestigious lawyers, you're probably at a commercial law firm, and you're not really helping make big change when it comes to health, education, climate change. You tend to be reactive, so like you're trying to fix problems that have already happened rather than being really positive and pushing things forward. So rather than go down the law path, I decided to go to Bain, which is a management consulting firm, and I didn't really know anything about consulting. Otago, where I did law, was not the most like outward-looking commercial kind of environment. The first time that Bain ever came to recruit on campus for their graduate program was the year that I was kind of graduating.
Yep.
And so I was curious about it because
Bain, they're one of the big three, aren't they?
Yeah, one of the big three management consulting firms. And so I was really curious about that because I knew that I kind of had this qualitative legal skill set of being able to reason through problems, like know which information is important, come to a conclusion, make a decision. But I had no skills when it came to like Excel. Like how to use numbers, to make decisions. Yes. And I thought that would be interesting and helpful. Also, Bain would pay me more. This is getting into the personal finance combo. Yes. Bain was going to pay me like double what I was going to earn as a judge's clerk.
Yep.
So that helped. And I knew that would be an international career. I was really itchy to get out of New Zealand and not just like challenge with law is that it is quite like limiting. You're kind of, you know, you can go to the UK or Canada or Australia, but that's kind of where your limits are. And another passion of mine is speaking Spanish. And so I wanted like the chance to be able to work and speak in Spanish. Yeah. So I joined Bain. I was lucky enough to get selected to join Bain. And I loved the interview process.
Yeah,
like I found it so energizing. Yeah. It was so hard and mind bending, but really just a whole way of looking at the world that I hadn't encountered.
Yeah, cool.
So they asked you questions during the interviews like, how many tennis balls get sold in Australia per year? Go. And you're like, I know nothing about the tennis ball market. And they're like, doesn't matter. Just think about it. Like, how would you reason from first principles an estimate of that? And it was interesting. I don't know if listeners will relate to this, but I find when people ask me maths questions, I just like shrivel up and die. Like, I'm pretty quantitative, but it's like this thing of like, I'm not good at maths, like that's all that my brain says. And so it was quite a challenging interview process, but they obviously saw something in me and took a chance. So I joined Bain in Melbourne and worked as a consultant there. Could talk about what that's like if that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What is that like?
Mm. So management consulting firms.
What do they do?
Yeah. So the big three you're talking about are Bain, McKinsey, and BCG.
Yeah.
There's also like PwC, Deloitte, KPMG. Yep. EY all have consulting arms as well. They basically help usually big companies with business problems.
Cool.
And they're like a squad that you bring in to diagnose a problem and then maybe create a solution. So that could be like Westpac. Our business banking customers don't seem to be happy for a couple of reasons.
Okay.
Can you go and survey them and come up with a solution for what products we should be offering?
Yeah.
And sometimes big companies want to bring an external perspective. It's fascinating work as a junior person fresh out of uni because you kind of get this business education, a lived MBA kind of experience.
True.
You're getting paid well for it. You're also getting absolutely flogged. So, like, it's super stressful.
How many hours?
usually, like, 80 a week, 70 to 80. And it's stressful in other ways because you are doing stuff that you've never done before.
Mm.
You're constantly you know, businesses, industries, problem sets, and you're also working often with the CEO or the CEO's reports, and they're kind of like, who are you? Like, and how old are you? So
are you in the right?
It's like a massive recipe for imposter syndrome.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
But in terms of like what I got out of it, it was worth it for all of that because it was
because
just
that,
like...
that's helped you now, right?
Yeah, it definitely helped me. Get outside New Zealand.
Yep.
Honestly, like it's a great brand to have on your CV. People kind of know what it is. It's funny because if you talk to Nikki, who's one of the founders of Blackbird, he'd probably be like, you're wasting your time. Like, who cares about brands? But I think if you're from a small town in New Zealand, you're kind of like,
it's massive.
It's a ticket. And like,
well, like you said, New Zealand is still a wee bit behind.
Yeah.
So it's still cool. I mean, like, it's still a big name.
Yeah. Although my parents are like, you're going where? Like, you're doing, what is your job? The best thing about it was just, I mean, working with incredible people.
Yeah.
Like, it just, you know, really smart, really kind, funnily enough. Bain has a great culture.
Mm.
Really smart people who just teach you how to think about problems.
Cool.
So I do actually come back to that Bain education a lot, especially like sitting on boards and just things that seem common sense to me are things that were more drilled in during those years.
Cool. So you've got that foundation of, I suppose, of a methodology of working things out. And go, I can actually just see that straight away.
Yep. And then also just learning how to work, because I think like you go from uni and just like how to write a good email and like how to navigate, you know, you're constantly being thrown into new group dynamics. Cool. And knowing a lot, learning to, a lot about yourself and other people and how to work with other people. Yeah. All that stuff has been really useful. And then some of the work I really loved at Bain, I moved to London after about a year in Melbourne, still with Bain. And during that time, I spent 4 months working for Lego in Denmark, which sounds cool. But it was like, it was headcount reduction.
Make Lego the whole time.
Sadly not. But we did. I did get to stay in the Lego hotel. So it was this weird situation of like coming back from, you know, finished work at 10 p.m., a day of like deciding who's going to lose their job, not deciding, but you know, helping the company decide. and then, you know, sleeping in like the Ninjago themed bedroom. Like it was very odd existence. And after working for Lego, I also did some work for private equity funds when I was at Bain. So they're a little bit like venture capital funds. They buy companies that aren't publicly listed. They usually buy a majority of the company, whereas as venture capital funds, we just buy like 10%. And they often, so they kind of like cruise around looking for big successful businesses that they can buy, make even better and then sell. And at Bain, part of my job was working with them, looking at a new company and saying like, is this a good proposition or not? So it was like that investor skill set. I got to practice that helping these private equity funds. But it's a funny job as a consultant because you kind of like every month you're looking at a new company. So it'd be like The Body Shop this week and then...
And totally different industry.
Yeah, next week it'd be like some random business in Spain that makes cleaning robots. And then it's like a chain of dental clinics. And you, it's really interesting if you're someone who's like very curious and loves learning a little bit about a lot of things. It's awesome. But, you know, as a consultant, you kind of like, you work on it for a month, something happens and then you never see, the end of the story. Dating, never getting married. And the private equity funds in general, like, didn't have the best cultures. They're like super male dominated, quite aggressive kind of cultures because it's like we buy this company, we change the management team, we like take on heaps of debt and then we sell it. And I just didn't want to be part of the industry, but I love the work. So that led me to investing, but in technology companies rather than like make stuff. Older companies, more traditional companies. And I left Bain to join Generation, which is Al Gore's fund. So sustainability-focused investing.
What was the best thing that you got out of working there?
Basically like an education in investing, because I'd come from like being a consultant, like knew how to use a spreadsheet and all that sort of stuff, but I never had to like build a relationship with a founder. Understand what makes a good business and how to really quickly understand if this is a good one.
So it's more involved in the business itself or with the founder?
More like just all these things that are the role of the VC, like how to find them, how to pick them, how to win the deal, how to work with them post-investment. Didn't get involved in fundraising so much there, but it was a really awesome like education and investing.
It sounds like your career path was... when you talk about it, it's like, oh, of course you're going to be a VC, right? Did every single part you have to do in your job now.
Yeah, but there were heaps of things where it could have gone the other way. Like at one point, I was still really passionate about healthcare in particular. I applied to the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, which is like a public health school, and I was really wanted to like work for Doctors Without Borders or do something in public health. And they turned me down because I didn't have a medical degree, and so I didn't do that. I almost got a job with a development consultancy when I left Bain called Dalberg. So they go in and do the same work that Bain does, but in developing countries, helping aid organisations, saying like what's the most effective, like, I don't know, setting up a small business owner network in rural Tanzania, things like that. Almost got that job, got down to the final two, and then I didn't get it. And so there's like, my career could have gone lots of different ways. But I do feel like I ended up in like the best VC fund in the world for me in the best role here in New Zealand. And I do think venture is like just the perfect job for me. And what's all the weird things about me?
So Blackbird investors right at the start. Is that risky? Sounds risky to me.
Absolutely,
extremely risky.
Yeah, something we didn't talk about is kind of like why we need to believe the big outcome every time we invest. So what we know is when we invest on day one, roughly half of the companies that we choose and do invest in will not exist.
Really?
In, really? You know,
so
you
know
that
it will be a given.
Yeah. You just know the odds are this company's not going to survive. That's because to survive, you have to keep raising money. Things have to go well for you to be able to keep raising money.
Yep.
And the things you're doing might just not work. And so it's a very high risk, it's a high risk asset class kind of investing. And so that's a weird feeling, right? Because you're like, you kind of know like half the decisions you make are going to be
bad. Investing your time into founders, into people.
Yeah. Yeah, and helping them ride the roller coaster and also realizing that, like, if they do, you know, fail in some way, that it's not true failure, but it's, like, the nature of the game.
Yes.
Okay, so we know that, let's say we invest in 10 companies in a fund. So we go out, raise the money. We've got a couple of years to invest it. We invest in 10 companies. Usually it's more like 20, but let's just say 10 because the math is easy.
Keep it simple for me, please.
For me, otherwise I'll get all like maths. Probably two of those companies will really succeed, and the value of the bit of those companies that we own will be worth enough to pay back our investors, hopefully times 3 to 4 what they gave us.
Okay. For the losses that you will incur from the 8 businesses that you invested in to cover that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, and obviously makes some more.
So say we have a $100 million fund.
Yeah.
We take some of that total money that investors give us to pay our own costs.
Oh, yep.
And then let's say we invest about $80 million in companies. Then for us to be successful, we need to turn that $80 million into $300 to $400 million.
Yeah. Wow.
And we also know that we're not going to, if you think about the $300 to $400 million, it's not going to be from all 10 companies. It's going to be from 2.
Yep.
And so working backwards, every time we invest, we have to be able to imagine a path where our tiny slice, 10% of a company, is worth $300 or $400 million. And so what happens is I meet a lot of amazing founders who are building businesses that just will never get to that size.
Yep.
And you know, to put it in context, then there are about 160 companies ever that have gone to more than $100 million in revenue. And that's like a pretty golden sort of size. Yeah. At that point, you're probably worth $1 billion or more. So there's been, you know, we've got maybe like 4 in our portfolio of 130 companies. And so these are the odds we're talking about. Yeah. And so when I pass on companies and I'm like, it's you, it's us, not you. It's just a
particular... It's not personal.
Yeah, it's just the maths of how, like, true venture funds work, and there's other kinds of strategies out there, but ours is very much like the highest risk, highest potential reward end of the spectrum. We're like, you know, foot on the gas kind of money for ideas that can be really massive and potentially have the ability to pay back the fund. It's called the power law. So, you know, you have like 1 or 2 power law companies per fund that are. Ideally, I mean, hopefully you have some.
Yeah, yeah.
But we'll see. Okay. And Canva is like a superpower law. So that first fund, $30 million that Rick and Nikki raised, that fund paid back 33 times what investors had given because of basically the success of Canva plus a couple of other companies.
Wow.
So that's the dream.
Yep.
And you only get that sort of outcome if you've invested right at the beginning when the company was cheap relative to what happened next.
Yes.
And that company does really, really well.
Yeah. Wow.
And then the other part of our strategy is not just to do that first investment, but when we've got a really great relationship with a company and it's going well, to invest in every round that they raise, sometimes leading later rounds as well. So because we also know if you've got a power law company in your portfolio, you'd be stupid not to try and invest more dollars.
Exactly.
And so that's why we have the strategy of like early stage funds and then later stage funds.
Okay.
But the reality is we don't follow on invest in many of our companies because we have to kind of respect the power law.
True.
And that's it's hard.
Yeah, that'd be tough.
Yeah.
It'd be really tough to do. Do you look at a business or an industry different to another partner? Like, say I had this. Say I had Canva. And I brought it to you in its early days. would you have viewed it differently? Like, let's say maybe you passed on it.
Mm.
If Kemba hadn't have got, say, Nikki,
yeah,
or another partner,
mm,
like, yeah, what are the
great
what
question
are the kind of implications of that to you guys? Like, obviously, you guys are trying to see as many companies like that all the time. Mm. And if someone passes, where does it go? Mm. Yeah, how do you guys view that or deal with that, I suppose, bias or
yeah,
because you've got your career path would have been different to someone else's.
Totally.
It's different to someone else's. Yeah, how do you guys manage that?
Yeah.
Whereas, I suppose it's a risk in a way.
Yeah, it is. One way that we guard against it is to have, we do have like a group that makes the decision about what we invest in. So if I'm excited about a company, I'll write up a short note about why I love it, why sure, I think the product's awesome, what we know about the customer love, why I love the founders, try and paint a picture of, you know, why this is exciting. Mm. Usually at the early stage, you're focused more on what can go right.
Okay.
We didn't talk about this on the fund, like, economics thing, but, you know, every time you're talking about offsetting the kind of the ones that don't work out, and you can only ever lose one times what you've invested.
Okay.
But the potential upside of what you can make from investing in the right thing, you know, is 60 times your money or whatever, or 1,000 times your money. And so I guess we're very like risk on in the sense that we'd rather make bad investments than miss the great one.
Okay.
So we tend to like make investments rather than not make investments.
See.
Okay, so when
or
it comes
have
to...
Have it go to the next stage in the process, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
Talk to it with, hey, is that how it happens? So you would go, hey, I've got this really cool company.
Yep.
You wouldn't sign on the dotted line straight away and just give them the money. It would go to a team.
Yeah,
right?
We have an investment committee for each
cool
of the funds.
Yep.
So for the New Zealand fund, the investment committee is pretty much like everyone on the team. and what's cool is so it's like a, you know, a jury of your peers.
Yep.
So I'll bring the company in. The founder will pitch to the whole group. And then straight afterwards, we all vote as to whether we want to personally do the investment.
Yep.
And you can vote hell yes, yes, no, or hell no.
Oh, wow.
And we basically, there's a rule, you can't just vote yes because it's too easy just to say yes.
Yeah. Yep,
and so if you're a hell yes, hell yes. If you're a yes, you're really a no. And so you basically have to vote hell yes or no. Or hell no. And what we do that, we do it blinded so that you can't see what, you know, more senior people or whatever. So everyone who's present at the pitch, whether they are on the investment committee or not, will vote and then we'll discuss the votes. And the amount of sort of love that you need, the amount of hell yeses you need to make the investment depend on how big the investment is.
Okay.
So if it's less than $2 million, if I feel really strongly about a company and everyone else is like lukewarm, I can push that through.
Okay.
If it's... more than $2 million, then we need three partners to approve it. But there are definitely cases where, you know, one person is super strong, hell yes, and other people are like,
really?
I don't really see it, but I'm willing to back your conviction.
Oh, so, I see.
But it's interesting because at Generation, where I was before this, it was quite different. We were doing much later stage investments, and it was a very different dynamic in terms of how decisions got made. It was a lot more consensus. There was a lot more evidence required, whereas as is appropriate to really early stage decisions where there's like, there is no certainty. It's all gray area. It's all like probabilities. And, you know, I see this magic in this person.
Mm.
We're much more likely to just make investments and back the conviction of someone in the team. Your question was about industries and whether like individual partners might look at the same thing differently. I think the main way this shows up actually is probably in like scar tissue. So, if you've personally done some investments in a space, like a particular kind of business model, maybe it's like, you know, plant-based meat or something, or you've done a biotech farm, like a new pharmaceutical deal, and, you know, oh, God, the regulatory pathways just killed that company, or over here, oh, the price just really got compressed and the margins weren't really there for it to keep raising venture capital. Whatever, you might have scar tissue from something that's happened.
It's not going
to
work.
Yeah, and so we do try it as a group to, like, that's why we have multiple people weigh in on the decision and then also, like, encourage people to acknowledge, like, oh, I wouldn't do this deal because I, you know, ABC, but, you know, I'll support you if that makes sense.
Okay. But I think, so you would go, because of my experience, I wouldn't do it. So I'm going to maybe take a step back and not let you guys decide, but maybe neutral and then, yeah.
A lot of it is just like explaining why you say what you say, like why are you a hell yes, why are you a no, and so that people can decide, is that like valid or like does that change their mind or not, kind of thing. But it's a really interesting one. I like to think that if Mel and Cliff from Canva pitched me, I would have seen the magic.
Yes, straight away.
I do think as I said, ultimately we're all kind of, we've all got our own tastes in founders and in business models. But when you meet someone exceptional, I think you know it. Okay. And I think that's sort of what we're all training is our own algorithms to spot exceptional people.
Wicked. If we keep going through this process, like let's say there's a yes from the investment committee.
Yeah.
Do you guys do more legal stuff, more due diligence on the business? What happens there until, do they sign a contract or is it the term sheet?
Yeah, cool. So let's talk about like a $2 million investment, because I think we'll probably do more work if it was a $20 million investment.
Yep.
But at that end of things, I probably, before it even came, you came in to pitch the investment committee, I would have probably spoken to a few customers.
Oh, I see.
Maybe spend a bit of time with other people in your team to get a sense of like who's building the product if you're not the CTO. And you know, that informs like the little write-up that I do for my colleagues so that they can come to the meeting with a prepared mind.
Okay.
So there's a bit of diligence that goes on first. And then if we're like super excited after the pitch and there's hell yeses around the room and we're like, then we can kind of say to you as a founder, like, we really want to make something work. Here's just like a few more things we need to do to like confirm that we're going to give you a term sheet.
Yeah, cool.
So that could be, we usually run references on the founder. It's very unlikely, but there have been like one or two occasions in the whole of Blackbird's history where someone's got like a really bad reputation for some reason that makes us think they're not going to be able to build a team and they're not someone that we want to associate with our brand.
Yep.
We do like police checks, make sure that you are who you say you are, all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
And all that stuff is because we are managing money on behalf of the taxpayer. This is different to like an angel investor is probably just going to trust you on your word and give you money. But we do a few extra things just because we're professional investors. So then in terms of the legal documents, so a term sheet is basically usually a one or two page document which says what our offer is in terms of investment. And so it calls out the major terms of investment and there's like a standard set of them that if you're a founder or an investor, these are the things you're going to actually negotiate on.
Okay.
There's all these long form documents like a shareholders agreement and a constitution, a sale and purchase agreement for the shares that are pretty standard.
Yes.
But they have these like variables in them.
Okay.
What's the price? How much are you raising?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is there a board seat? All this kind of stuff. And that's what we're actually negotiating. So we do that first. Cool. And then we say like, if this looks good to everyone, let's just go make it true in the documents.
Yep.
Yeah. But we negotiate on this like quite small set of things.
Yeah.
So usually if you're a founder, great outcome would be for you to have multiple term sheets from multiple funds, lots of people that want to invest in you, and then you have your choice of who you're going to work with.
Yep.
You can maybe, you can choose the best price.
You can work with more than one.
You can work with more than one. Basically, you're choosing your lead investor.
Okay.
The reason we say lead is like you want one person who is going to take all the documentation and like who's going to be on the other side of the table as you get the documentation formalized, and they do that on behalf of all the investors that come in that round.
Cool.
So if you're an angel investor, you don't usually negotiate the legal docs and stuff. You don't have your own lawyer. You just sign up to whatever the lead investor has negotiated. Gotcha. So that's kind of our role.
Yeah.
It's like,
okay. Yep. Setting the terms. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Nice. You know, and when people are pitching to you, let's talk pitch decks.
Oh, yeah.
This is a funny concept. When I heard the word pitch deck, I was like, what are those?
What did you think it would was?
I had no idea. I was like, pitch.
Yeah, there's probably heaps of lingo that's so opaque from the outside.
And then this is a pitch deck. And I'm like, oh, a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, Canva. Okay, yeah. Canva, I know what those are.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, in terms of pitch decks or presentations,
yeah.
is there an ideal like number of slides that people want to see? Are there certain things you want to see on that?
Man, I think every investor will probably answer those differently.
Yeah.
But if you think about what it is, a pitch deck is basically
if
like...
If someone will show one to you, you go, hey, this is what I want to see.
Yeah.
This is what I need to see before I even think about a hell yeah.
Yeah. Well, the pitch deck that you send to someone over email before you've had a chance to meet them, your goal with that is to get a meeting.
Okay. Gotcha.
And so what you want to do with that is pique their interest. So you want to explain, like, there's so much. What I care about is I want to know who you are and what your connection to the problem is, if it's relevant. If you've come, like, something in your life story or your career history that's led you to fixating the problem that you're solving with this company, then I want you to talk, like, have that front and center of the pitch. I want to know who you are and who the team is.
Yeah, cool.
Because we're investing in people. I want to know what the problem is that you're solving. I want to know what the product is like. So what does it do?
Okay.
You can link to a product demo if it's a software product, or you've got a video of it working if it's a hardware product, or anything that just, like, paints a picture of what it does. I want to know if you've got some people using it, whether they're paying or not. Tell me, share in whatever way you can the sort of customer love. It might be engagement data. So, like, we launched in January, and, like, by March we had this many users. They were, using our product X days per month. However you measure the health of your customers, like, share that with me. I want to know, not essential, but, like, how much are you raising? What are you going to use the money for?
That's important.
So those are a few things. But I guess the most important thing is to make it beautiful, especially if it's, like, a consumer product, because we're betting on you to build a brand and, like, be something that the consumers just, like, want to pull out of your hand. So make it, relatively simple and easy to understand. And the goal is just, like, make it exciting enough that someone's going to be like, oh, I'm interested to take a meeting, because, we have so many potential meetings each week, and we do have to focus on a certain number and then keep focusing through this, like, pipeline, if you get what I mean. Otherwise, you'd be working a lot of hours.
Yeah. So how many coffees do you do a week?
Yeah, probably, like, do you mean, like, new founder conversations?
Yeah.
Depends on the week.
Brand new, like, first, the first pitch deck has piqued your interest, and then you do coffee or a meeting.
Yeah. Probably about 5 would be typical.
Okay.
Does that sound like much or not much at all?
No, it sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot, because it kind of goes like this, because when you get, then you get, like, buried in something and you're, like, going deep on it, you're kind of, like, pushing all those other meetings out a couple of weeks. So it's, like, it goes in waves. Like, this week I think I had 6, and I'm like, man, that's too many, because...
Crazy.
You know, and, like, and just such different businesses.
Yeah. Do you get fatigued? Like...
Yeah, it's super energizing. Like, I love, my favourite thing, like, is just, like, meeting someone and hearing about their business. But
do you need, like, a break? Okay, cool, no more businesses.
It's just, like, the context switching is quite intense, because, you, like, even today, before I came to see you, had a meeting with Ron Simpson, who founded Xero, about a new idea for, like, a founder event that we're thinking of, and then straight from that into talking to this awesome ex-professional runners who have an app called Femi, F-E-M-M-I, which is, like, sort of like Strava but for women, and it's all about training around your menstrual cycle, which is something that not many people know about. Straight after that, went into another business that is, like, construction software, and then I ran an Ask Me Anything session about a new role that we're hiring, and then I came here. And so it's, like, just the context switching is quite wild, but I love it, but it can be too much sometimes. So, yeah.
Wowzers.
So if I say no to a meeting for you, it's because your pitch deck wasn't good enough. No,
yes,
but it's also partly, like, sometimes
pitch deck sorted.
Just so snowed under with different things.
Yeah. Who have you spotted, like, since being in your role and you've made investments into?
Oh, yeah, okay. One interesting one is a company called Vivi. Have you come across them?
No.
They do digital collectibles, NFTs, but of amazing licensed content, like they're a partner with Marvel Comics. So now if you go and buy a Marvel comic from a comic store, you'll also get a digital version of that in the Vivi app.
Wicked.
So the founder there, David Yu, is a lifetime collector. He is from the North Shore. Well, he actually grew up in Taiwan and then moved here when he was about 7. And right from childhood, he was like a mad collector. He would get old envelopes where the stamps had not been minted, soak off the stamp, put them on a card and sell them to tourists on Queen Street. And he used that to buy phone cards, which were like a real big thing in the early 90s, like a collector thing. And then he sold those.
Yes, I was around then.
Like the telephone. I was too.
That's the internet.
And then he sold those to buy his first game store of like, you know, physical collectibles.
Yep.
Statues, comics, figurines, all that sort of stuff. Playing cards. And for years he ran a network of those businesses. They still exist. And then at some point he was like, everything else is going digital. Like books are going digital. Mm. What's going to happen to collectibles? Surely there's going to be some digital version of those. This is like 2017, so just before, like a couple of years before people, before the NFT craze. Yeah. And he and his co-founder, Dan...
before the hippopotamus came out.
Exactly. Exactly. Before the bored apes and the...
Yeah.
The dogs,
yep.
The Shiba Inus. And so they went to all of these large licensors that own IP, like Pokemon or Jurassic Park, you know, and said, we want to make digital versions of your collectibles. Things that you sell, distribute through game stores, like, let's make digital versions. They'll cost you very little to make and you can make extra money. And they were like, well, that sounds great. Like, no one's going to buy them because would buy a digital collectible? But sure, here it have the rights. And so they got these insane, like, literally just pounding the pavement.
Just here have the rights.
Yeah, sneaking into meetings, like, pretending they had a meeting with the executive, whatever, just showing up. And so they launched the Vivi app in December 2020 and just coincided with basically this massive wave of interest in digital collectibles.
Yeah.
And... So they had this insane experience of, you know, getting to hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue over a couple of years but from being first to market and having a really good product. So that's one example. And it's like this untold Kiwi success story.
Yeah.
They're too busy to like – he doesn't do much podcasts. But
they don't need to do any marketing, I suppose.
Well, they have a really loyal fan base globally.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, but it's not – I mean, not that many New Zealanders know about it.
Okay.
So that's one example.
That's cool.
And then I could talk about a couple of founders in Tauranga. There's David, who's actually one of our Māori founders. We don't have many. We can talk about that. I know that was a topic of interest. But David Pene, he was at Zero. Actually, he used to be a backup dancer for Stan Walker.
Oh, wow.
I know. And then and then he became a software engineer.
Same industry, yeah.
Yeah, pretty similar. And he was at Zero for 6 years and then... founded this company, Care Patron, with Jamie, his co-founder. That is sort of beautiful practice management software for therapists, nutritionists, health coaches who want one software where they can book clients in, record their meeting notes, have an AI tool that listens to and automatically records the session, notates the session. A space to collaborate with their clients. So, you know, I send you this treatment plan, you can comment it and send it back to me, manage their billing, all that sort of stuff. They launched that in Tauranga, but about half the customer base is in the US, another 20% is in Latin America. They do that all from here. So that's another cool...
What's their name?
Care Patron.
Care Patron.
Yeah, another investment I love.
Good work.
Yeah.
Good work. Going on... from what you said before, how many Māori and Pacifica businesses has Blackbird invested in?
Zero Pacifica and two Māori founders, yeah.
And what's Blackbird doing anything to support that growth?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think one way we support the growth is through storytelling and bringing together, like through events like Sunrise, trying to be very intentional about who's on stage what perspectives they're bringing and to bring a wide range of perspectives. I think we have one of our main focuses at the moment is gender diversity, first and foremost, because we also have a massive gender problem in our industry, like, let alone, you know, Pacifica women or Māori women. So that is certainly something where we're sort of starting there and investing a lot in ensuring that 40% of the teams that come and make it to our IC stage have a woman in the founding, a woman in the founding team. And I think we'll keep chipping away at these objectives. So at the moment, if we were to set an ambition around the number of Māori or Pacifica founders that were coming through our pipeline, I'd be ashamed at the level that we'd have to set that at. Like, even if I said 10%, I don't think I could find 10%.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So we have a real it's a pipeline problem, but it kind of is, because it's it's like awareness of tech companies as a way to solve big problems.
That's right.
I do think the style of investing we have, it does tend to suit a particular personality type, which does tend to be, like, it shows up more frequently in white males who have seen people go before them, follow this path, who have similar ambitions, who want to be, like, they want power and and money and, like, you know, they want they want to achieve big things.
Be a global founder.
And, like, most people don't want that and don't actually want what that means. It's a freaking hard road.
True.
And so I would never say, like, you should be following this path. It's got to feel authentic. It's got to be what you want. And there are so many other ways to build a business than take money from the likes of Blackbird. But we're here for the person who does have that massive ambition.
Cool. How much of your role is science versus art? Like, how many times have you seen in Blackbird that partners have made an investment based on a gut feel or, like, you know, on the art side of things?
Yeah, it's probably 70 or 80% art.
Really?
Yeah. Wowzers. I think the science is, well, let me put it this way. The science is not really complicated.
Okay.
People talk about venture maths. It's not difficult maths. It's more like having a mental model for what businesses will work or will be sort of, you know, of the quality and can be venture-backed businesses, as in they, you know, could become really big independent public companies. It's more like pattern matching than it is science. It's mostly about, so I suppose you're always, like, comparing the thing that comes across your desk to all of the examples you have in your mind of what went well and what didn't go well. So there's, like, some science, like, there's pattern recognition and repetition. But the art is actually way more important, because it's a gut feel of, like, is this person going to do something extraordinary? And do they want to do what?
I don't know, that I find that fascinating for some reason.
Yeah, I think it's something, like, I've definitely come more from an analytical background. And so I, even now, I'm definitely working on trusting my gut more. Doing things like sleeping on it, like having a pitch and then, like,
Funny, those old school sayings are actually hold a lot of truth to them, right?
Yeah, they do. So seed investing is much more, it's as much gut as head, and it's as much art as science, maybe even the majority of art. There's a cool, really awesome, if anyone's interested in the space, there's an amazing investor called Cyan Bannister, and she did a cool episode with Patrick O'Shaughnessy on Invest Like the Best, if you're interested. She was talking about, she joined Founders Fund, which is one of it's Peter Thiel's fund, it's one of the best VC funds in the world. And she left because they were all, like, way more head analytical style investors, more accustomed assessing bigger, later stage companies. And she was like, she's just a wild believer in the future.
Yeah.
And I want to be more like her, is what I'm saying.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. And obviously you've seen, heard, you know, when businesses go wrong, when they fail, when they shut down, what happens to the money that you guys have invested in, and do you guys support them, or, what happens?
Yeah, as I said, about half of our companies will fail, so, or, you know, quote unquote, won't return money to the fund, basically. So fail from our perspective, but we don't use that word. And so, it's always tricky when this happens, because founders, of course, can't, like, they have a strong belief in what they're building, they have a strong ambition, and when things don't work out the way they want, like, they're just not getting product market fit, customers just aren't buying what they're putting out there, or it's not going as well as it used to be, it's really heartbreaking because it's so much more than a job for founders. And I think, you know, first of all, we just respect and have empathy for the founder in that moment, because it's very different being a founder than being an investor in a business. We know, like, you know, we know the probabilities. This is the game that we're in. Like, of course, I would rather your business was an incredible success. But the fact that it's not, you know, we're not going to get any money back, that is just the rules of the game. And I don't feel necessarily emotional about that. But I'm here to support you in this difficult time. So what it usually looks like is supporting over a number of months or years as the business, maybe you reduce your team because you might have some customers but not enough to be growing and adding team members. And there's some version of your team that can work sustainably where you're profitable and you don't need to keep raising money. And a lot of my time would be helping get founders to that realization and then making it happen and then getting them feeling good about the new version of the business. Basically, we're always here to support founders until they are no longer ready to, then they no longer want to fight, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Yep. And that's their prerogative.
Yeah, true.
So we're minority investors, we don't own your company.
Oh, yes.
You know, we
yes.
don't decide what happens to it.
Yeah.
We usually, we're a minority investor, we own 10, 15%. And so for the most part, it's like about supporting the individual or the team.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, but it's really common. We've got... practical ways we help. If you are letting people go, we'll try and find them new homes in the portfolio and other companies.
Yep.
We provide a service called Sonder, which is actually a portfolio company, which is virtual counselling and support.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Let's talk personal finances.
All right.
Do you consider yourself to be good with money?
So funny, but actually, no. I think there's a few reasons.
Yeah.
One, I think it's probably just my disposition. Okay. But working somewhere like Bain, you often like 3 or 4 nights a week, you're eating food at the office.
Ooh.
You've got like a $100 dinner voucher. So you're like getting like beautiful, I don't know, not that I eat steak, but like steak from down the road or whatever.
Yeah.
And so your whole idea of like money gets really distorted really quickly.
Yeah.
Because you have this kind of expense account that you're going out for these amazing dinners, you're like flying business class, all this stuff.
Yeah,
and so it's quite hard to maintain sensible amounts of personal spending when like during your week you kind of have this different lifestyle. At the same time, you're getting paid pretty well. So I'd say my personal finance philosophy is try and get paid a lot so that it doesn't matter.
not spend more than I earn, just earn heaps more than I'm spending.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Basically, that has always been my approach.
I've never heard of that. Really. I actually like it.
I know that I'm not great at, I'm not particularly disciplined. I wouldn't say I'm terrible, but I'm not particularly disciplined. And so I really have to like earn a bunch more than I need in order to like save.
So the word budget?
Yeah.
Do you use that word?
Do you have one? Not really.
Do you have family? Do you have a family?
This is like going to the dentist. Let me tell you a bit about... Let me tell you a few more things. So one thing I do really care about is like getting rid of debt. So part of the reason I went to Bain was like I can pay off my student loan.
Yeah, awesome.
Quick smart. Because as soon as you get out of New Zealand, you're paying like 8% interest or something on that, which is wild. Yes. So I paid that off in like 2 or 3 years because I was getting good bonuses at Bain. So it was really worth it on that in that sense.
Yeah,
it
just when I was in the UK... And I started getting charged for my student loan. I was like, it's time to pay that off.
Yes, yeah. So that's one thing. Always get rid of debt first. And then I'm a big believer in just setting up systems, which mean you don't see money. So basically, I 10% KiwiSaver contribution.
Cool.
Big fan of that.
Nice.
Like just get it taken out of your pay. You don't even see it. And then invest, just have a regular auto buy on stocks. So I just buy ETFs.
Okay.
So these are like, you know, very diversified, very low cost to buy. stocks like the S&P 500 ETF.
Who do you do that through?
I used to do Sharesies. That's probably what I'd recommend because it's easy. Now I use IBKR, International Brokerage or something, which has got lower fees. It's a little more complicated to – it's not that hard, but –
But tricky to drive.
Slightly more tricky, but way lower fees. Okay. So it was really good if you make the effort.
Cool.
So basically like – dollar cost average in, which means like just invest the same every week. Don't try and call the market.
Yeah.
Just invest in the lowest price indexed stocks. Yes. Don't try and pick certain names.
Yeah. So index are the best companies out there put into one fund and you're just putting money into that.
Okay. Yeah. And I should probably say this isn't investment advice.
Yeah, this is not investment advice, by the way.
But
if you need financial advice, seek that from a professional.
Yeah. Not us.
Yeah.
And I think one thing I learned from my time at Generation, which is the where I was before Blackbird, their company started off just investing in public equity. So these like publicly listed companies, and they are one of the best. It's a hedge fund, basically. That's one of the best people, like sets of people that are doing that in the world. And each of the individuals in that team that does that kind of investing, they have about 10 companies that they cover in depth. So like someone might cover like, you know, Google, Microsoft, NVIDIA, Apple, or whatever. And they know so much about those companies. And their whole job is to basically say, what's the right share price? And if it's way lower than that, let's buy it. If it's way higher, let's sell it. And they spend, they're like some of the smartest people I've ever met. And they spend all their time just looking at 10 companies. There's no way you can do better than them. So don't even try.
Yeah.
Just basically put your money in ETFs. It costs you
awesome.
It costs you as little as possible. Market go up, your money goes up. Like, don't mess with it. Compound interest is the seventh wonder of the world or whatever.
Right.
So just that's my other advice. Like make it, just set all auto, take it out of your salary straight into Sharesies or whatever.
Yeah, cool.
If you're into crypto, you can do a little bit into Easy Crypto and be, you know, diversified in that sense.
Yep.
For me, in terms of family, I've got a, my partner Richard, he's actually like a personal finance expert.
Oh, wow.
So we can talk about that if you want. And like his journey is actually pretty fascinating. Because he went from like full-on frugality lifestyle to basically retiring through really good money management. He's 33.
Wow.
Really different to me, like a lot more disciplined. And
What does he do? Is he a financial planner?
So or he was a business journalist, and then and he wrote a lot about personal finance.
Okay.
And he wrote a book called Optionality, which outlines a bunch of the stuff.
Cool.
But basically, he was working as a journalist, so he wasn't earning heaps of money, not amazing salaries, but what he did was like reduce massively his cost of living. So first of all, he never took on a student loan. He went somewhere that he could get a scholarship, didn't really care where as long as it was a scholarship. By contrast, I had a full scholarship to Auckland and my parents were like, no, you shouldn't go to Auckland. Go to Otago, it's a way better experience, like, and get a massive student loan. And I didn't even think about it at the time. Anyway, we can go into that. Yeah. But okay, so he was all about like reducing his cost of living.
Cool,
so he went
So that's a different theory to the one that
very
you
different.
Said before.
Yeah. Very different. So he's a different person. He's like, I don't want to have a job. I wanna get myself into a position where I don't have to have a job.
Yeah.
And whereas like I love working, I'd rather do my own strategy. So he moved to like Thailand and Colombia and so on, like lived in these countries where it was really cheap to live and he could work remotely as a journalist, you know, for staff and some of the New Zealand publications. And then he wrote his book. And something that is relevant as well, he believes in a barbell strategy where you have, which I do too, so you should have most of your money in really low cost assets like the exchange traded funds that we just talked about. So use Sharesies to just invest in a couple of diversified ETFs, put most of your money there. That's like at this end of the barbell.
Cool.
And then you should have some bets that have potentially massive upside, but could also go to zero. So you don't want this to be all your portfolio because they could all go to zero.
Yeah.
But it's really a great idea to have some. And most people don't even think about this bucket. Mm-hmm. So for me, this end of the barbell, it's really my job in Blackbird. We can talk about like how the economics of VC funds work, but if they go well, basically I make some money.
Cool.
If they go really well, I make some money.
Yeah.
So that's my like there's salary and like sure stuff savings down here.
Yep.
And then,
so it's kind of that low risk, sure bets there.
Yeah. And then here, and that can be like that's your KiwiSaver basically.
Yeah.
And then up here it's like invest a couple of thousand dollars in a startup. The way he thinks about it is, when he talks about optionality, is like, it's everything from reading a new book because you might learn something in a book that that you never would have thought of, and it will send you down a path.
Yes, yes.
Or you might meet a person who goes on to start a company, and you help them in the early stages of their company. You get a few shares, and then the company's worth something.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of like ways to think about it. But basically, think about how can you invest some of your money and time in things that could be really massive. And startups are a really interesting way to do that. Crypto, yeah, like for some people, is, is something.
Is it through places like StartMate? Or how are you doing that?
It's off. Well, for someone like him who's not, who's like an interested person but not in the tech scene, it's getting to know people who are about to start a company and helping them. So it's like actually more about building one-to-one relationships. StartMate is interesting. That's a mentor-driven accelerator. So you have all people who are experienced at running tech companies, and they put in a little bit of money, like $5,000 or $10,000 of their own money, to a fund. And that fund goes to support about 20 companies that are really early stage. And so, yeah, that's a great example. I used to be a mentor in StartMate.
Oh, cool.
And so in a couple of those funds, I put my personal money, and then, you know, it's early days yet, but those might pay off at some point. The thing with this end of the barbell, especially if you're talking about startups, it's usually like a 10-year road. So this is why it's
long.
Many people would never have even the spare cash to do this.
Yep.
And so it doesn't apply to everyone. But if you are someone who, you know, is good at saving, like my partner, and you've got a bit of money to play with, think if there is a way you can give, you know, 80% of it to this strategy down here, but 20% up here. And if you're a young person, you should be trying to put your money in high growth, slightly riskier stocks down here, even though it's the lower risk end of your strategy.
Yeah, cool.
Mm. I admire him. And we've got an 8-month-old daughter.
Oh, nice. Zara. Nice. 8 months. Oh, very cool.
Yep.
So be flat out for you guys.
Yes. Yeah. I just came back to work a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
Getting adjusted to that. But
what do you have any guilty spends? Like, what do you like spending your money on?
Probably food. Nice. Farro Fresh. It's like my biggest weakness.
Nice.
Going into Farro and buying like all the treats. Pretty good at, actually I have a commitment this year, which is like not to buy any new clothing and just to buy secondhand clothing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's not going that well, but I'm trying.
It's early stage.
Yep. And then buying stuff for my baby. Because I'm like, yeah, she needs it.
Yeah.
She doesn't need it.
Have you made any investment mistakes?
Oh, yeah. God, loads. Yeah, definitely. And there's two kinds of mistakes. There's like doing an investment that you shouldn't have done, and there's not doing an investment you should have done. And the second one is much more painful.
Definitely.
I don't think there's too many big ones there yet, but that it'll take time for that to become obvious because I've only been back here and investing for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But on the you know, investing where I shouldn't have, I don't know, like it's more art than science.
Yeah.
There were things that now I would not make the same decision because I've learned so much about what to look for.
Yeah.
And you only learn by making mistakes. And I'm lucky to be at Blackbird where that is understood and encouraged.
Yeah,
and there's lots of environments, lots of funds where that culture is not in place.
Mm.
And I think that would be a hard place to grow up as an investor.
Yeah.
So we've just had someone join our team, and my advice to them was like, just come in, make a bunch of investments, little ones, because as I said, like if you're only investing a small amount of money, it can only go to zero.
Yeah.
But the potential is that it could become a lot. And you'll just learn so much by, you know, putting money on the line, putting your time on the line, and working with those founders. It's the only way to learn.
Cool. What's the ultimate goal for Blackbird? Like, is it to become like Sequoia or someone like that?
Yeah, I think for Blackbird as a fund, we want to be one of the leading seed investors in the world and be recognised as one of the best places to take investment if you're a founder, so a real founder-friendly brand, and be relevant, like compete with the best VC funds in the world. And that's part of like our investment in going to the US and the UK is relevant to that. I think in Aotearoa, I see a huge potential for the tech sector and for startups and for amazing people to channel their energies into startups in order to change the world that they live in. And so for me, it's about expanding, growing the pie of our industry. That's all elements of it. Founders, talent that's going to work for their companies, people who are going to invest in their companies. There's just, it feels like we're about 10% of our full potential, and there's just so many ways that we can develop in terms of people, money, impact.
True.
I think once you've, if you've worked in a corporate and then you go to a startup with other epic people, you just feel the difference where you're like, you're really having day-to-day, you're creating something out of nothing together with other people who are really ambitious and motivated.
Mm.
And I think it's just the best environment to work in lots of ways. Maybe there's some downsides as well. You're not going to get like very structured training. Your manager might not have done the thing before.
You're not going to get a business card to go with.
No, it's different. It's probably not exactly 9 to 5 all the time, all that stuff. But if you're the right kind of person, then it's an amazing environment to be in. You learn so fast. So I'm just passionate about more of that.
Awesome.
And driving that.
Awesome. And what's the goal for yourself personally? And for you and your wee whānau?
Yeah, well, I think it comes back to where I started, which is I just love making a small, even if it's a small positive difference in the world. So by helping, companies succeed and gain that global status if they're doing something really meaningful for customers.
Yep.
So I think of companies that we've been able to back and take to scale, like Halter, which saves dairy farmers.
Yes, I have seen them.
Hundreds of hours a year, means they don't have to get up at 4 a.m. to move the cows.
Yeah, that's
but
amazing.
Also makes cows more productive and happy and makes better milk. Yeah. Through to, we've got a company in Wellington called OpenStar, which is attempting they're trying to build a reactor for nuclear fusion. And if that works, then we'll have abundant, basically free energy. I mean, it's a real crazy bet in a way, but if it works, it will be absolutely world-changing. I'm still passionate about healthcare, education, climate change, and I just think startups and technology innovation are the best, most efficient ways to make change in those areas compared to policy, legal, law cases, and big corporates that just can't move with the same pace as startups. So I'm here to invest my time and energy and experience in the next generation of founders building in those areas.
Awesome. That's amazing.
And build Blackbird Aotearoa into
the
envy of Blackbird, which it is already, because everyone thinks we're really cool.
You guys are, in terms of VC, you guys are the cool one.
I mean, within Blackbird, people think New Zealand's really awesome because we're like 5 people out of the whole 55 company, and everyone's like, I want to be in Auckland. It's the cool office.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Oh, yeah. Nice. Well, thank you so much for coming on Fresh Money. If people want to reach you and send you their interesting, amazing pitch decks,
yes,
how can they reach you?
They can email me at phoebe@blackbird.vc.
Cool.
phoebe@blackbird.vc.
Sweet. Yeah.
Awesome. And I promise to reply. I don't promise to meet you.
Yeah.
But yeah,
no promises. Cool. You are not obliged to do anything. But you'll have your links and details on the podcast. So cool.
Thanks,
thank you so much.
Thank you.